Welcome to Your Health, the podcast brought to you by the Health Desk here at National Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Davis. In today's program, what doctors think about the Massachusetts healthcare plan, and we'll hear what age has to do with your insurance premiums. More students are seeking mental health services on college campuses. We'll hear how students at a California university are coping. And headphones, they might not be good for everyone.
In the age of wonder, another world, another time.
We've all been wondering, as we see our friends and coworkers coughing into their sleeves, just how long is the new H1N1 flu contagious? The current public health recommendation is that if you've been sick, you can go back to work or school 24 hours after your fever goes away. But a new study says, hold on, even then you might still be contagious. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The finding comes from some very alert scientists. Last summer, Catherine Takis-Woodcop and her medical colleagues at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado were presented with an opportunity. 1,400 new cadets had arrived at the academy. Between June 26th and July 4th, there were few cases of flu-like illnesses. After a party in early July, the numbers skyrocketed as cadets came down with fevers, cough, fatigue, and other symptoms. It was all very clear to Woodcop.
Within approximately 10 days of their arrival, we saw an increase in respiratory illness among our cadets. And what we learned within a very short period of time was that this was a novel H1N1 outbreak.
A total of 134 cases of swine flu and 33 suspected cases, 11% of the cadets. The Air Force Academy set up an isolation ward, two floors of a dorm. They wanted to know how soon they could send the cadets back to basic training. The government's advice? People can return to their normal activities after 24 hours of no fever. But the Air Force Academy doctors realized no one really knew for the H1N1 flu. They got the cadets to agree to nasal washes, a squirt of saline in their noses, and look for any viruses that came out.
19% of those samples from cadets who were more than 24 hours symptom-free actually contained live virus.
Woodcop of the Air Force Academy says the findings suggest people who are going to be in high-risk settings, hospitals, daycare centers, or around pregnant women, should stay home longer or keep their distance. At the CDC, Dr. Ann Schuchat says she's not surprised that the study, reported in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, describes some of the cadets as still shedding virus after they were well.
What's important to say is that shedding doesn't mean you're spreading.
And she said the advice remains the same.
People should stay home for 24 hours after their fever is gone without taking anti-fever medicines. And that really is a balance of making sure that most of the transmission is prevented. And yet we're balancing how long and how disruptive our interventions are.
You can't isolate people for days after they're well, says Dr. William Schaffner, head of preventive medicine at Vanderbilt University.
It's not possible to have a plan that's completely safe. We're trying to do what's best, but also be practical.
People are most infectious in their first couple of days of illness and a day before symptoms appear, he says. A completely safe policy would mean isolating everyone. Schaffner says the finding is a reminder about personal hygiene, that healthy people, people who've been sick, and people who might get sick should wash their hands frequently, and when the urge to cough hits, do so into your elbow. And he's got one more piece of advice.
The best way to avoid all this is to get vaccinated just as quickly as possible.
Following that advice could take some time. At the moment, the vaccine is mostly in limited distribution, available primarily to at-risk groups such as healthcare workers, pregnant women, people with chronic health conditions, and kids. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
Now on to healthcare. You might remember that a few years ago, Massachusetts passed a law that aims to get nearly everybody health insurance. And so far, it's working, because the vast majority of Massachusetts residents have health insurance that's 97%, more than anywhere else in the country. Critics of the Massachusetts approach say it costs too much and that the system can't handle all those newly insured patients. But according to a new poll, doctors think the law is really working. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
It's 12:30, and Dr. Phil Trifletti is grabbing a quick lunch. leftover chicken from the weekend. One of my wife's recipes. It's a chicken pesto.
Trifletti's a busy primary care doctor in the working-class town of Chelsea, just north of Boston. The thing that's different these days is that virtually all of his patients are insured, thanks to the 2006 law.
It's certainly nicer for me to be able to be available to more patients in my community.
Over the past couple of years, there have been reports that so many people have signed up for coverage that primary care doctors can't handle the load. That's not the case here. If you call Phil Trifletti's office as a new patient, you'll get an appointment in about 3 weeks.
You know, I can't say that we've been swamped or overwhelmed. I don't feel swamped by it in any way.
Trifletti's not unusual. The new poll shows most Massachusetts doctors think the law's working pretty well.
They are very supportive of the law. 70% said they favored the law and overwhelmingly wanted it continued.
Dr. Robert Blendon of the Harvard School of Public Health ran the poll. It's published online today by the New England Journal of Medicine. Blendon says previous polls show the general public likes the new law, but doctors like it even more.
They were just quite impressed, both in their own practice and statewide, that the uninsured problem has essentially disappeared from their lives.
And doctors don't think the law's affected their quality of care at all. Patients still get the same amount of time with the doctors, and only 13% of doctors think their payments are too low. When the law was passed, people worried that insuring hundreds of thousands of new patients would result in long waiting lists. Well, 62% of the doctors in this survey say, in their practice, it's not a problem. Again, Robert Blendon.
They did see shortage of primary care services as a problem in the state, but two-thirds did not think it was a problem brought on by the legislation.
Now, not all doctors say they love the law. 7% would like to see it repealed. But a spokesman for the Massachusetts Medical Society says it's hard to find a doctor to say so publicly. Many Massachusetts doctors are worried about the cost of insuring everybody, so as the general population, polls say. There's growing consensus that something serious needs to be done about the cost of health care, which is heavily subsidized by the state. But for now, the doctor's verdict on the Massachusetts health care plan is surprisingly positive.
All right, so let's have you sit up on the bench there. We'll listen to your lungs and check your blood pressure again.
Phil Trifletti, the primary care doctor in Chelsea, Massachusetts, is back to work.
Next deep breath. Let out. Your lungs sound perfect.
Trifletti is happy to hear that most Massachusetts doctors feel the way he does about how things are going.
I'm glad it's popular, and I think it has worked well. And I fully agree that, you know, having doctors supported is a good thing, and I hope that that has some political clout in Washington.
But Trifletti says what's really going to count is whether Massachusetts can continue funding its popular new health care program in the face of whopping budget deficits and big budget cuts. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Now let's talk about the cost of insurance for folks in the rest of the country. If you get insurance through an employer, the price you pay is not strictly based on your health. It is based on the age and health of your coworkers. If you work with a bunch of young and healthy people, your rates are probably below average. If your colleagues are older and less healthy, then you may pay a lot more. From member station KQED, Sarah Varney explains how group rates are set.
I've got my paycheck here, and let's see, there's this long list of taxes and deductions, Social Security, Medicare, a little money toward my retirement, and the biggest deduction of all, my health insurance premium, a whopping $600 a month for a standard Blue Cross HMO plan for my husband, my toddler, and me. My employer kicks in another $1,000 for a grand total of $1,600 a month. That's a lot more than what other businesses of the same size in San Francisco pay, and I wanted to know why.
Hey there.
Hey, what's going on?
I'm here to interview Joanne about group health insurance rates.
Excellent.
It turns out my company pays a lot more for our health plan, not because it's some fancy Cadillac coverage.
We have an, I don't know how to say this, an older workforce.
Joanne Carter is head of the HR department at my public radio and television station in San Francisco. The average age of employees here is 47. That's more than 7 years older than the regional average. I talked to Ed Kaplan at the Siegel Company, a human resources consulting firm. He spends his days poring over spreadsheets used to set insurance rates around the country.
That's a pretty big age difference. And then a group with an average age in the late 40s versus 39, that could be a 10 to 20% difference in medical costs just for the age difference.
The actuarial tables don't lie about our age. Every year we get older, our medical claims go up another 1 to 2%, says Kaplan. It's one of the first questions prospective insurers ask an HR department.
They would ask for the census of the group, so the age and sex and the single family status of the workforce. They would ask for 2 years of month-by-month claim experience.
For companies with more than 1,000 workers, insurers are more likely to base their rates on historical claims data. But for smaller companies, health plans rely more on age and gender.
In the private market, group insurance is really social insurance. So in a typical employer group, roughly half the employees will have no claims in a given year. And so they're paying a premium, and there's some people in that workforce who are going to have $100,000 in claims.
As a younger, healthier person, I may subsidize the older workers at my company who need more medical care. But I also get something out of it. My coworkers who don't have kids help subsidize coverage for my family. And that's the point of group health insurance. We all take our chances together. The health care bills under debate in Congress would do little to change how insurers set prices for employer-sponsored health plans. And they do nothing to solve this hiccup in the free market. Insurance companies might decide your company is not a customer they want.
We're a nonprofit agency, and being nonprofit is not very attractive to insurance.
Lily Chin is KQED's benefits manager. She says insurers have told her flat out they won't underwrite nonprofits for fear they'll go belly up. And others won't give her a quote because our company, with about 240 employees, is too small. Yes, insurance companies are businesses too. They have target markets, sales goals, and preferred customers.
Some underwriters and insurers go after certain types of industries more than others. For example, they may go for more professional groups rather than blue-collar industries or the things of that nature. So there's all these different mix of markets they go after. That's based on their history. Are they making more or less money in a certain segment of the market, in certain regions of the country?
They decide to get competitive and they want more business, so they'll undercut their competitors.
Stephen Lindsay is a licensed insurance agent and a lobbyist for the California Association of Health Underwriters.
In effect, they put insurance on sale. Instead of charging what it really costs, they charge 5% less so they can get more business.
So how come I never see that sale? How come I don't get those sale prices? It seems highly unlikely that my company will ever get offered a sale price on health insurance. We are not and probably will never be El Primo preferred gold-plated customers. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.
They may not tell even their roommates, but according to recent surveys, the number of college students seeking help for serious psychological problems has soared in recent years. And all across the United States, campus counseling centers are straining to keep up. In next week's podcast, we'll hear about what colleges are trying to do to meet the need. Today, from the kids' perspective, NPR's Deborah Franklin takes a look at mental illness from the inside out with her report on a group of students in California who created a theater production that got their campus talking.
Amanda Galender is a senior at Stanford University, confident with a big laugh. As she recalls, she was having coffee off campus last winter with a new friend, a freshman, when it struck her that he might not be as happy as he seemed.
He starts talking about his friend in the dorm, who's really, really depressed, and like he feels really bad for this kid. And I just had an instinct. I don't know why I did it, but I just told him, I'm bipolar, and I know how hard that is.
Amanda had spent her freshman year depressed too, crying under the covers for hours and exhausted, trying to hold everything together.
And I would cry on my way to class. And every day when I got home from class, I told my roommate that I had to take naps. And it wasn't about anything in particular. It was just sadness, a sadness that I couldn't shake. And I didn't care about anything. I didn't care about my friends. I didn't want to socialize with anyone in my dorm. And this was very uncharacteristic of me. I'm someone who dives into activities and academics. I didn't want to get help. I thought I could do it on my own. So It was just a very lonely time.
The young man listened to her story and confessed that the depressed friend was really him. It was a relief to them both to come clean, but Amanda and her friend wondered how many others were suffering, and that's when they got their big idea. Both are members of a student theater group that shines a spotlight on social issues, homelessness and AIDS, farm workers and pesticides.
We decided that it would be great if we could get stories to show that there is such life happening under the surface about mental illness, that there is so much struggle and triumph going on.
So they sent out an email to everyone they knew on campus, asking for anonymous true life stories. And within half an hour, Amanda got the first response. She brings it up on her laptop.
Am I the only person who never feels good? I've always felt this way from as long as I can remember, and all I've wanted is for somebody to say, I know how you feel. I am the same. We are all the same.
Dozens more letters poured in. What it's like to be hauled off to the psych ward for observation, or to stand at the edge of a high balcony and fight with yourself to keep from jumping. Before we tell you what Amanda Galender and her friends did with all that email, you first need to know these kids' struggles are not unusual. A Stanford task force on student mental health last year reported what it called an unprecedented demand for psychological services on campus. Roughly twice as many students seeking help as a decade ago. To try to keep up, Stanford increased its staff from 10 therapists to 16 in just the last year. Other schools are even more swamped.
We're not seeing that it's specific to elite schools by any means.
Daniel Eisenberg is a mental health researcher at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He cites surveys of college counseling directors published over the last decade, schools ranging from small community colleges to the largest universities.
And one of the questions is whether they're seeing an increase in the number and severity of students with mental health problems, and over 90% are saying yes to that question.
Here are some more stats from colleges nationwide. More than twice as many students are on psychiatric medications as a decade ago, and there's been a 50% increase in the diagnosis of depression. Last January, Amanda Galender, the Stanford student you heard earlier, was determined to go deeper, to give all those numbers a human face. So she and her troupe of actors turned some of the letters they'd collected into 25 monologues. One even came in from a student resident advisor in the dorms.
One night, I sobbed in bed until 5 a.m. I imagine depression feels different for different people. For me, it felt like an elephant was sitting on my chest, constricting my heart, and I could barely breathe. I'm not supposed to be like this, I kept telling myself. I need to be strong. Other people come to me for help. I started to panic. What if I can't graduate? What if I have to drop out of medical school? What if I can't take care of a family?
The actors took their show to various places around campus, making sure faculty and the counseling center had a chance to hear the stories. But Amanda Galender says there were two audiences that were most important.
First and foremost, people who were struggling with mental illness and thought, there's no one else out there like me. Secondly, we're trying to reach people in dorms who are complicit in creating an environment that is hostile to people with mental illness, even if they don't know it.
And so they performed in 13 student dorms, too. Stories of severe anxiety problems, obsessive compulsive disorder, and eating disorders.
It doesn't help my self-esteem that people think of bulimia as a joke problem, gross and unrespectable. It's an issue of control. Who overeats like a dumb animal and then has to vomit because they have no self-restraint? Me, apparently. It's embarrassing. But beyond that, it was also that I was on a varsity team and knew that if news got to my coach or the sports medicine, I would risk my spot on the team.
When you hear OCD, you probably think of some Jack Nicholson type. Neat freak. Really uptight. But that's not me at all. Hell, in terms of neat, I live in a frat.
By junior year of high school, I couldn't even listen to the radio during a traffic report because I would just know that my family had been in an accident. I started thinking that every furtive-looking man on the street was a terrorist, that every plane flying overhead was going to crash into my house. 20 milligrams of Prozac a day changed my life. So I went to Stanford relatively healthy, happy, and excited. In December, my young grandmother died of a sudden aneurysm. That winter quarter, I had a panic attack in the middle of a math exam. It was time to seek help again.
The stories inspired lots of Facebook discussion about mental illness. Some students found the production too disturbing, but Amanda Galender got a lot of positive feedback, especially from resident advisors, the RAs.
I spoke with an RA who said that this was probably the best thing that has been done for mental health on campus in a long time. He could really sense a change in his dorm.
So the Stanford student actors got what they most wanted, to dispel some of the stigma of mental illness. It's a good start, but is there really some new epidemic of psychological problems on campus? Researchers say it's doubtful that today's teens are actually sicker than past generations. Instead, they suspect what we're seeing is partly the unintended consequence of a good thing. 20 years ago, many high school kids with an illness as difficult as bipolar disorder or major depression might not have gotten treatment or even made it to college. Again, the University of Michigan's Daniel Eisenberg.
When Prozac and other antidepressant drugs came onto the scene in the late 80s and in the 90s, the likelihood of teenagers getting mental health treatment went way up.
Now, with earlier diagnosis and better treatment, they're on every campus. And when they have problems, many more are turning to therapists for help. Deborah Franklin, NPR News.
Now here's some news that might make a few Apple customers think twice. 2 years ago, a researcher reported that an iPod can interfere with a pacemaker or an implanted defibrillator. But the story was questioned largely because the researcher, Jay Thacker, was a 17-year-old high school student. Now, there's a new study, and it turns out Thacker was wrong, but not totally. NPR's Joseph Shapiro tells the story.
Dr. William Maisel was intrigued by Thacker's research. Maisel is the founder of a center that studies the safety of medical devices, and he was at the scientific meeting of doctors when the Michigan high school student presented his paper.
I think it was provocative, and I think in many respects he deserves a lot of credit for bringing the issue to the forefront and for fostering more study of the issue.
But Maisel was skeptical that an iPod or other digital music player could cause a pacemaker or defibrillator to malfunction, and a subsequent study by the Federal Food and Drug Administration showed that was highly unlikely. Still, all this got Maisel thinking about another part of the iPod, the headphones.
But what we did know was that portable headphones, the type of headphones that are used with MP3 players, contain powerful magnets, and magnets can interact with pacemakers and defibrillators.
Headphone magnets vibrate a speaker, and that creates the sound waves that we hear. Maisel is a cardiologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. His study's in the new issue of Heart Rhythm Journal. The scientist was surprised when he started testing those headphone magnets. Most were very strong, more than 20 times the strength needed to interfere with a pacemaker.
Well, pretty quickly we realized that we were onto something because the first thing we did was we went to our local electronics store and bought every headphone that they had.
And where'd you go? You went to like the Best Buy in Boston?
Well, exactly. We actually did go to Best Buy. We bought 8 different portable headphones that were on sale, ranging in price from less than $10 to $100.
To test those headphones, Maisel brought in 100 patients with pacemakers and defibrillators. He put the headphones on their chest and monitored the devices. In 30% of cases, the headphones created interference that could block the implanted cardiac devices. But it was an easy problem to fix. You just had to keep the headphones a small distance off your chest.
So we advise patients to keep headphones at least 3 centimeters, or which is 1.2 inches away from their chest wall, because we did not observe a single interaction when the devices were kept at that distance. And so what that means for patients is that they should not place headphones and drape them over their chest when they're not wearing them. They shouldn't put them in a front chest pocket or a front jacket pocket. They shouldn't have a loved one wear headphones and rest their head on top of their device. But it also means that it's okay for them to use headphones. It's okay for them to listen to music because the distance from their ear to their device is sufficiently far that there will not be an interaction.
As for that Michigan high school student, he's no 17-year-old whiz kid anymore. He's a 19-year-old whiz kid. Jay Thacker is a junior at Michigan State University. He's continued to publish studies that look at whether iPods can interfere with medical devices.
I think we got people thinking about something that maybe wasn't as prevalent in the medical community before. I think it just reinforced in people's minds that with all these new technologies and with technology continually developing faster, we really have to keep an eye on how it's going to interact with these different medical devices so that we can keep patients with them safe and keep them aware of what's going on.
Ask Thacker what he's listening to on his iPod these days, and he has a hard time naming any music. Recently, he bought a review course for the admissions test for medical school.
They have an MCAT review out, and I copied that onto my iPod from the CDs, and I think that's all I've been listening to in the car, when I'm running, just nonstop, I've been listening to these CDs.
Jay Thacker takes the exams for med school in the spring. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health. Please join us again next week for more select pickings from the Health Desk here at National Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Davis. Thanks for listening.